Hi, just before you listen to your 3CR podcast, a quick message. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening and enjoy your podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith, and this week we are joined by author and journalist Jonathan Katz of The Racket. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love the name of your podcast. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Jonathan, I guess just to begin with, you made it a bit of a splash a couple of years ago when you put out an article about the Nazi problem on Substack, which I trust has all been resolved in the interim. But for our listeners, could you perhaps tell them a little bit about what you uncovered when you looked into Nazis on Substack initially?
Yeah, so the background here is that I was on Substack. I wasn't the first generation of adopters, but I was pretty close. I had started my newsletter on Substack in 2019. And so I'd been on it at that point for 4 or 5 years, I guess. And I guess by the time the story ends, I'd been on it for almost 5 years. I guess when it begins, I had been on it for about four. I started looking into things because Substack management, who I knew, I had friendly relations with. They had actually, Hamish McKenzie, who's one of the co-founders, had personally reached out to me in 2019 to be like, hey, do you want to start a newsletter on here? It's like, yeah, I could think about that. And so we'd been very friendly and we've been conversing for many years. And they had a guy on their flagship Substack podcast named Richard Hanania. And I was familiar with Richard because I used to spend a lot of time on Twitter, of blessed memory. And Hanania was a real racist. So he was not a nice person. How about that? He was just very deeply racist on Twitter. And like that was kind of his big Twitter personality. And I had encountered some of his writings on Substack, and they were basically eugenicist. Very kind of, oh, well, the problem with life in America is that Black people just love doing crime. And if we would just send the police after Black people and keep them from doing crime, then everything would get better. That's kind of his position. And I was like, why are you promoting this guy? And I started looking even more deeply into him and found some even stronger, just super white supremacist leanings that he had had. At the time that I started looking into him, and I don't think it was unrelated, the Huffington Post, the American online news magazine, did an investigation into him and found that not only was he an open racist in 2023 when I was writing this stuff, but a couple years before, he had been a writer for overtly neo-Nazi, white supremacist publications under a pseudonym. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Richard Spencer, the American Nazi, the American white nationalist, who was a big figure in media during the first Trump administration. His big moment was helping lead the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that ended in the death of a young woman named Heather Heyer. Richard Spencer had personally recruited Richard Hanania to write for one of his publications, alternativeright.com, which is the source of the name alt-right. And I was like, what is, like, Substack, what are you doing? And Hanania responded to this HuffPost expose by being like, oh, well, that's not me anymore. Yeah, I wrote some bad stuff when I was younger. But then he didn't really recant any of his like core past views. Like he was basically like, well, back then I wanted to, you know, prevent non-white people from reproducing. Now I just want to police them to death and close them out of public life. It's totally, I've really reformed. And yet Substack continues standing behind him. And around this time, because I'm out there reporting on this stuff, by the way, on my Substack newsletter, this is where I'm doing this reporting, people start reaching out to me and are like, Katz, like, yeah, Hanani is there. And through him, I was able to find some other unsavory characters. But they were like, there's some really hardcore, like open Nazi swastika stuff, kill the Jews kind of stuff on Substack right now. You should really look into that. So I did. And I found an entire ecosystem. And that ranged from, again, like just like open Hitler-heiling Nazis to eugenicists to sort of softer, more media-savvy white supremacists, including, by the way, Richard Spencer and a lot of the guys who ran the rally in Charlottesville in 2017. And I did a story about it. And I was originally just going to publish it on my newsletter. But I was like, more people should know about this. So I ended up reaching out to The Atlantic and they ended up publishing my story.
Jonathan, I've gotten the sense that this might have been a slight frustration for you from some of your writing about it. But it seems you uncovered quite a significant number of Nazi bloggers on Substack. You highlighted a small sample of them in your reporting, but there were many more, and it seems like all that happened was that a couple of the ones that were highlighted got kicked off, and the actual problem was never dealt with by Substack.
Absolutely. So the thing was, there's a number of pieces of this. First of all, I was, and in consultation with people who do a lot of reporting on extremism on the internet, I was sort of caught between two instincts. My instinct as a journalist was, I've found all these guys, they're writing this really ugly stuff, they're doing these things, I should name them and expose them. But in so doing, especially in a publication like The Atlantic that has a big international readership, I could also very easily end up publicizing them. And we sort of ended up going kind of a middle road where obviously I didn't link to any of them. At The Atlantic's insistence, I published a couple of names of a couple of these just alt-right to neo-Nazi to just white nationalist Substacks and quoted some of them a little bit. And I also pointed to in that piece the fact that a lot of the criticism, both from Substack management and some of Substack's biggest earners, was that I was just trying to cancel people, that I was just trying to gatekeep the platform and get people kicked off. What I was really highlighting was it's one thing to have hate speech on an internet platform, right? It's the internet. There's going to be hate speech on it, and different platforms can have different terms of service, and they can draw their line in different places. One of the things that I brought up in that piece that I think got a lot of attention was that I had found, just kind of searching around, at least 16 just like openly Nazi swastika, like Hitler imagery Substacks. Those is a general principle on the internet for the last 30 years or so, that like, if you're an open you're like, I'm a Nazi, you're going to probably have a hard time, at least in the pre-Elon Musk and pre-Substack era, being like, I'm going to be on this internet forum, like posting like open Nazi stuff. But there are other things that, like Hanania, that are very, and also Richard Spencer, like his Substack, that are, they are consciously towing the line. They're testing to see how far they could go. And in many cases, they aren't really violating terms of service. But the thing that Substack was doing, and the thing that Substack has continued doing since, to an even greater degree in some cases, is not just allowing their platform to be used for these guys, not even just allowing their platform to be used to monetize these guys, which is also a thing, right? A lot of these guys, including Richard Spencer, including a number of the blogs that I talked talked about in my Atlantic piece have Substack bestseller badges, right? It means that they're getting enough, they're making enough money off of this thing to like get sort of a little, you know, designation of success from Substack. But Substack was out there actually actively promoting some of these guys. And one of the guys who Substack has been promoting, so obviously Hanania was one example, and Hanania, they were having him on there, and even after he's outed as like somebody who had had this past as a hardcore neo-Nazi white nationalist, he was coming out with a new book. Basically, the point of his book was, let's basically reverse most of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, right? The signature piece of legislation in U.S. history that was used to dismantle Jim Crow segregation in the U.S. South. Hanania is like, let's get rid of that. Let's make that so it's not effective anymore. And they're still out there promoting him. There's another guy named, and I'm saying the name because his name is everywhere these days. His name's Daryl Cooper. He's a podcaster. He has a podcast on Substack that has tens of thousands of paid subscribers and far more total subscribers than that. Substack has, and Substack management has in their internal communication, like their it's not internal communication, it's to the world, but like their branded Substack, this is who we are as Substack Communications. They recommend this guy over and over again. I created an account, a new account, so I could look for some of these guys, not using my main Substack account. And one of the first, it immediately recommended to me a couple of Substacks that I might want to follow, pre-selected them, right? So all that I would have to do is kind of think that I was clicking out of the window and I would immediately be subscribed to them. And one of them was this guy, Daryl Cooper's. Cooper made headlines a couple months ago because he went on Tucker Carlson's new show and defended Hitler and defended the Holocaust. He was saying that, you know, Winston Churchill was the greatest villain of World War II. He said that basically, oh, the Holocaust was just a misunderstanding. The Nazis, when they invaded the Soviet Union, no discussion about why the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, but when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, they suddenly had all these prisoners of war, and it would have been less humane to allow these prisoners of war to starve themselves. So they just started exterminating them because that was the nicer thing to do, right? This is guy. He is the number one history Substack on the leaderboard and has been for well over a year. So again, it's not just a case of like them giving these guys a platform or the tools to grow an audience and to promote themselves. They are actually out there with their full chests saying, we run Substack and we think that these are some guys that you should listen to because they have some really valuable things to say. The thing about Substack is that it's effectively a social network. And when you have a Substack newsletter, you can, and you're encouraged to, recommend other Substacks for people to follow. When they sign up for yours, that you are automatically given an opportunity. And again, these boxes come pre-checked. These are known as dark patterns on the internet. Like you kind of trick people into subscribing to things that they don't know that they're subscribing to, because a dialogue box pops up and then you might think that you're just clicking, you know, go away dialogue box, but but the button that you've actually clicked is subscribe me to all of these other newsletters. And so it creates this ecosystem for people to talk to one another. One of the pieces of journalistic malfeasance that recently got a fair amount of attention from other media in the U.S., especially the Verge wrote about it, Mother Jones wrote about it. Verge is a internet publication. Mother Jones is kind of a left-leaning online magazine or print magazine as well, was that the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago now, did a story about Zora Mandami, who's the left-wing Democratic nominee for mayor of New York, about how Mandami, when he was applying to college, had checked off a box for a diversity box on his application to Columbia University, saying that he was African-American. And the reality was that he checked off the African-American box as well as the Asian box, because he was born in Uganda to Ugandan-born parents who were of South Asian descent. And he kind of just didn't know which box to check. He was just sort of like, I am African-American. I was born in Africa. I'm now in America. I'm also Asian. which of these boxes should I check? And also, this is an important piece, he didn't get into Columbia. But on the American right, there's this obsession with race and college admissions, especially to Ivy League schools like Columbia, and this idea that basically that if you're Black, or if you can claim to be Black, you get some kind of special advantage that then gets you into the most elite universities in the United States. And then you, in so doing, you displace more deserving white people. Like, none of this is true. This is a ridiculous worldview, but it is really, really like very close to the core of both casual and hardcore white supremacy in the United States these days. So the idea was this non-white, but also non-Black mayoral candidate in New York tried to game the system by using these supposed advantages that privilege Black people over white people. The thing about that story was that the way that the New York Times got that information was, and this is based on a lot of investigative reporting by some of the publications that I just listed, was that a neo-Nazi hacker had hacked into Columbia's admissions database, found Mondani's application from, you know, I think it was like 2009. They shared it with another white supremacist, very eugenicist Substacker who has himself in the past described himself as a national socialist, actually a Jewish national socialist is how he's described himself. And then he handed it to another guy who's on Substack, who basically does a bunch of like just asking questions, reporting about trans people and trans care. So it's kind of basically this is like a neo-Nazi hacker gives it to a Nazi white supremacist eugenicist Substacker, who gives it to an anti-trans Substacker, who then gets the lead byline on this story in the New York Times. And I wrote a piece recently because Substack sent out a push alert, a Nazi push alert to a lot of its subscribers that literally it had they couldn't have been more on the nose here. If you got the push alert, you got a push alert with a swastika with a little Substack logo in the corner. And this got people's attention, and Substack was like, oh, we're sorry. We made a
whoops.
Whoops. Sorry about that. And so a number of people had written about this, and I was writing about that, and I also noted in there that this episode had just happened in the New York Times, and that really this is basically kind of Substack working as designed, at least since its more reactionary funders, especially Mark Andreessen, who is the inventor of Mozilla, of Netscape, who along with Peter Thiel is kind of one of the big reactionary tech funders of American politics these days. He's done a huge series of major investments in Substack, including participating in the major funding round that they just closed, in which they got $100 million worth of funding on a valuation of over $1 billion. And basically, since Andreessen has come in, like, this is effectively what Substack is. Substack is a place where anybody can create a newsletter, but they make a point of promoting and helping cultivate this right-wing ecosystem, which, again, ends up attracting the most extreme derelict genocidal voices on the right who are simply growing in numbers and prominence on the platform. And effectively, this kind of neo-Nazi to eugenicist to anti-trans to New York Times pipeline, that is exactly what they were trying to do from the beginning.
Jonathan, a few years ago, a number of different leaders of social networks made sort of claims about what the red lines were for them. I remember Mark Zuckerberg saying Holocaust denial, absolutely never on Facebook.
Right.
Elon Musk even said, you know, Alex Jones, who created lies about children dying at Sandy Hook, would never be allowed on Twitter because Elon said, I held my own dying child in my arms. I know how painful that is. And for someone to lie about these children never existing is just reprehensible. All of that just seems to have gone out the window.
It really has.
What your thoughts were on that?
My thoughts are complicated on it. I mean, it's fairly simple. Like, I don't think that Holocaust denial should have a place of prominence in public life. I'm actually in the midst of writing my next book right now, which in some ways kind of came out sort of tangentially out of the experience with Substack. And by the way, on that end, I ended up leaving Substack for reasons that had a lot to do with the Nazis. Also, just the way that Substack management handled this and sort of undercut and tried to, you know, just embarrass some of the people, not really me, but other people who were trying to speak out against them on this. And so my newsletter, The Racket, is now hosted on Beehive, which is just another newsletter platform. Because there are lots of other newsletter platforms out there that people can get to. But the book that I'm writing right now is really about, in the 1970s, a group of neo-Nazis based in Chicago tried to hold a march in a suburb of Chicago named Skokie, which was home to, it was a disproportionately large Jewish population, and also was home to several thousand Holocaust survivors. And the Nazis were defended in their attempt to march by the American Civil Liberties Union, which has been, at least since its founding around World War I and in the 1920s, the preeminent civil liberties and pro-free speech organization in the United States. And actually, one of the things that the people who know about the Skokie story know is that the lead lawyer, one of the lead lawyers who defended the Nazis, was himself Jewish. And the Nazis effectively won their case. The Supreme Court, it's a little bit more complicated than this, and this is why I'm writing a whole book about it. But the short version is the Supreme Court basically said that the Illinois Supreme Court, which is the state that Chicago's in, needed to act a little bit more quickly on affirming the Nazis' First Amendment rights, or at least deciding whether they had First Amendment rights. And then ultimately, basically, the courts affirmed the Nazis' right to hold a march in a public place. But then one of the things that people don't know about the story is that, like, the march never actually ended up taking place. And there's a lot of other things that go into this, which is, again, why I'm writing a whole book about it. But that one of the things that really comes through is that in the aftermath of the Second World War, you have this giant hegemonic liberal system that has just won the war and is now asserting itself and is kind of trying to figure out who we are and what are the rules going to be going forward, right? And this is the era that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations, comes out of, the big international organizations come out of, the American military-industrial complex comes out of this. Modern intelligence agencies really come out of this era. So basically, the world as we have been living in it for the last 80 some odd years, it comes out of this moment. And because it comes out of this war, and because it comes out of this moment in which the Holocaust has happened, was allowed to happen by the Allies, and the Allies feel very much in their souls that they have blood on their hands in various ways, that they didn't do anything to stop the genocide. You know, the United States in particular didn't really allow in a lot of Jewish refugees, actually turned back Jewish refugees, sent them back to Europe and had them die. You know, also, by the way, asylum law comes out of this era. All of these things are coming together with this great sense of guilt, and also this great triumphal sense that liberalism has defeated fascism, and that and Nazism becomes obviously the sine qua non of fascism. And so kind of built into this system from the beginning are these questions of how do we balance civil liberties and freedom, because this war was supposedly ostensibly fought for freedom, especially in Europe. How do we balance individual rights, rights of expression and freedom with this very deep hegemonic and I think ultimately correct understanding that Nazism is really, really evil, and that the Holocaust and the Nazi genocide was a historically monumental crime that can never be allowed to happen again. How do you balance those things? And this is why things like Skokie end up becoming these really interesting flashpoints, because those two things come into conflict with one another. In the United States, it's like we have the First Amendment, we have a right to free speech, we have a right to peaceably assemble and you know, petition for redress of grievances, and that is supposed to be available to everybody regardless of their point of view. But then you also have this point of view that created the catastrophe of World War II and the Holocaust. So if you give that right to the people who did that thing, aren't you just going to end up back in the same place that we were in 1939, right? And this ends up becoming a tension that kind of gets a slight resolution in the Skokie case in the United States, but this tension kind of continues up to the present day. And so I think a lot of what has happened there that you were talking about is that everyone loves, especially in the United States, everyone loves free speech. Everybody loves that we have a right to free speech. We can say whatever we want. We have the free press. This is all great. Also, everyone hates or hated, at least in at a hegemonic level, like in terms of like the American mainstream and even like multiple, you know, concentric circles outside of the American mainstream. Everybody hated Nazis, right? So it was for a long time, there was just this norm that was like, okay, we'll have free speech, but like that free speech can't apply to Nazis. It can't apply to people who defend the crimes that World War II was born out of, and that the liberal global system that we live in and that we feel safe in both had to expend so much energy and blood and treasure to defeat, and that also in a lot of ways came out of in its modern form. But the thing is that it's very hard on a philosophical level to hold those two thoughts in your head at the same time. Like, it's really hard to be like, everybody has free speech is good, but also allowing free speech for Nazis is bad. So it was really just norms that kind of kept those two things in check with one another. And what has basically happened is that it has now been 80 years, and the World War II generation is almost gone. The number of Holocaust survivors who are still in the world are dwindling, and they are very old. And the people who are still alive now were very young, even when the Holocaust happened. So a lot of like the firsthand communal memory in countries like Australia, the United States, Great Britain, France, of why these things were so bad is kind of going away. And you've got this ascendant reactionism. You have, you know, Trump acting in all these authoritarian ways, just blowing through things that would have, to people who lived through World War II and the succeeding years, or grew up with parents who lived through this, would have been just completely unthinkable, completely unacceptable. And so those norms of like, well, yeah, you can say anything you want, but like, you shouldn't say that the Holocaust didn't happen, it's kind of going away. And it's dangerous. It's a dangerous thing to go away. It's very hard to be a philosophically consistent free speech absolutist and also say like, but that those freedoms shouldn't extend to these guys. The way that most media, social media platforms did it is they're private companies. They can write their own terms of service and they could do whatever they want. And so they can say, we don't want you on here. And by the way, Substack does ban other things. This is one of the things that I've been talking about ever since I started talking about the Nazi problem on Substack, is that like Substack has no problem, you know, bringing down the ban hammer on things that it considers to be pornography and also like overt calls for violence. Like that's in their terms of service, even though those things are, you know, could theoretically be protected under at least U.S. law under the First Amendment, certainly pornography. So they're not free speech absolutists in that way. So it's just about what norms they want to, it's just about what norms they want to uphold. And the reality is that norm is shifting, and it is really hard to say where that's going to go.
Jonathan, just shifting gears to the current genocide, you wrote recently about the Washington Free Beacon's coverage of the famine in Gaza. They put out some reporting that was proven to be incorrect, that people were cooking the books in terms of declaring a famine. I've also, just before we got on, I saw Barry Weiss's Free Press did some amazing reporting that they Googled the names of a number of the starving children in Gaza and found
I'm laughing because I'm so sick. I don't want people to think I'm laughing at this, but I'm so fed up with it. Anyway, go on, please.
Found not only were they starving, they were also sick, so which was something the Hamas-friendly media had declined to mention, that the starving children also had rickets. It seems, though, that it's very important for them to disprove that there's a famine, because it does seem that images of starving children are moving the needle for the centre-right politicians in a way that maybe children being blown apart hadn't previously.
Right.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. What has happened is, I mean, Israel has had a very often crippling blockade against Gaza dating back to 2006, and an extreme blockade ever since the invasion began in the wake of October 7th, 2023. What happened most recently is that there was just a complete cessation of food allowed to go into Gaza for about 11 weeks. And this took a crisis that was already a really severe hunger crisis, and put it on steroids. It turned it into just an absolute catastrophe. And so this became apparent. I mean, you couldn't close your eyes to it anymore. Even with Israel killing journalists and preventing foreign journalists from entering Gaza without an Israeli military escort, it just became, even people who were in this supposed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that was kind of cobbled together by U.S. contractors and Israel to sort of do these kind of gesture level food distributions at which people keep getting shot by the people who are giving them food. Even some of the people who participated in those, whistleblowers, are coming out and being like, people are starving and we're killing people at these distributions. And so it just became an impossible thing to ignore. So what do you do when the thing that you're very overtly doing becomes impossible to ignore and you want to keep getting away with it? You lie about it, you attack the people who are trying to call you out on it. So on July 29th, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, better known as the IPC, which is basically a UN NGO national government consortium that goes around the world since the mid-aughts, evaluating the severity of food crises according to this five-step scale to try to put some scientific rigor on when you actually declare a famine. The IPC has been warning about horrific food crisis conditions in Gaza for well over a year and a half now. Basically, the entire Gaza Strip has been in level 4, which is emergency. But they were waiting to pull the trigger on level 5. And they still actually haven't officially pulled it yet. But they issued an alert. Well, two things happened. One was the New York Times, which is a major worldwide voice and has really given cover to Israel. It's given grave deference to Israel's points of view on a lot of things since October 7th. They came out with a stark, you know, page one story about Gazans dying. And by the way, the headline of that story was something along the lines of, like, it was like, young, old, and sick Gazans are dying of starvation. So they had the word sick in that original headline. And there was a really, really dire photo of a child who's being held by his mother. He's skeletal. You can just see his ribs and his spine through his back. It was a really powerful photo. It looked like a pieta of the Madonna holding Jesus. And it really was evocative. This kind of stuff and other reporting really got the world's attention. And actually, it was only a couple of days after that the IPC put out an alert which said that the worst case scenario of famine was unfolding in Gaza, which was not an IPC declaration of famine. That is still to come. They don't really declare famine. That will have to be reviewed by this other ad hoc committee, the Famine Review Committee. There's a lot of moving parts, but suffice it to say, like, this got the world's attention. And so the Washington Free Beacon, doing sort of freelance defending for Israel, came out with a story that the IPC had changed its methodology to make it easier to declare famine, which, again, they haven't even done. And that just wasn't true. It was one of the easiest lifts of investigation that I've ever done. I just wrote the IPC and I was like, is this true? And they were like, no. And they backed up their claim. And then I did further research to figure out that indeed they had not changed their methodology. The Free Beacon claimed that previously you needed 30% of children showing acute malnutrition in order to declare a famine, and that they had just quietly changed it to 15%. Not true. There's multiple ways of measuring. And basically, according to one way of measuring, which is height for weight Z-score, it's a statistical modeling, you would need 30%. But by measuring, if you use this other way, which is called mid-upper arm circumference, so literally measuring basically the emaciated biceps of children under five, it's a much starker form of starvation. You only need 15% in order to give this evidence. And also, that wasn't all the evidence. There's other things that they're gathering, including lack of access to food, just the ways that people access food. If they're the number of people who are just literally eating garbage and literally, you know, digging through rubble to find remnants of food that are left over from airstrikes. They use all these different things, and as well as deaths from malnutrition, to come up with their final determination, which, by the way, they still haven't even come up with. And yeah, they just were completely wrong. And the thing that one of the things that was grossest about the Free Beacon story is they had apparently reached out to the IPC for comment. They didn't wait to receive the comment. They just put out their story. And then they stealth edited in a couple of extra lines that was like, well, actually, yeah, there is this other way of measuring, but it hasn't really been used for declaring famines before, except it has. It's been used as a piece of evidence in South Sudan in 2020, in Sudan in 2024, and other places. And then they finally like put in this very misleading and non-attention getting editor's note at the bottom that no one's aware of. And so, yeah, as you said, Barry Weiss's Free Press had a story today just saying, and in addition to the fact that like these kids have rickets, which is, by the way, caused by malnutrition and other disabilities that contribute to the fact that malnutrition hits them harder than it hits other people, which doesn't mean that cerebral palsy causes you to starve to death. It just means that you are more susceptible to malnutrition than somebody who doesn't have a comorbidity like that. They, in that story, they had a line that said, and by the way, the IPC slashed their requirement from 30 to 50% just to make Israel look bad. Really, really aggravating stuff.
Yeah, I don't think Israel needs any help looking bad. It struck me that there was I felt like I was picking up a bit of a churlish vibe from some quarters that are, there was recent photographs of some of the hostages, the Israeli hostages, who are looking quite emaciated. And the fact that the people didn't seem to pay as much attention to them as they did to these children. And it's like, well, yeah. who is ultimately responsible for the hostages being starved, really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I did a newsletter in the racket several months ago, maybe even a year ago, that was just called The Uses of Hostages. And the hostages have played a really interesting role in basically as a casus belli for Israel. From the perspective of Israelis, the hostages kind of are the war, and they remain convinced, a lot of people remain convinced, that if Hamas would just give back the remaining hostages, I mean, at this point, I think there's like 20 still alive in Gaza. Most of them have been liberated. Many of them died. Many of them have died in Israeli airstrikes. as well. But their idea is this sort of like, well, if Hamas would just give these remaining hostages back, and by the way, a lot of the remaining hostages, I believe, are also soldiers, so they're really more prisoners of war. But regardless, like if they would just give them back, that the war would end. I don't really think that's true. There's been huge marches in Tel Aviv, and I believe also Jerusalem, over the last couple of days, criticizing the Netanyahu government and calling for an end of the war. But they also, like, they're holding pictures of the hostages, and the reason they want the war to end is less because of the suffering that it's visiting on Gazans, although that is, I'm sure, part of it for some Israelis. But it's really like, oh, our hostages are still there, and you're not bringing them back. You're going to kill them. And so, yeah, for some people who kind of have that reaction, why aren't you paying attention to the hostages? That's just been their reaction to everything ever since October 7th. Anytime you talk about anything, any death toll in Gaza, any number of children who've been killed, any number of neighborhoods that have been destroyed, the response is always, what about the hostages? What about the hostages? What about the hostages? To some people who I've encountered online, they use those pictures of the hostages starving as evidence of, you know, Hamas's depravity, without even thinking about the context of they're like, they'll kind of try to make the claim like, well, Gazan children aren't starving, only the hostages are starving, which makes no sense. But yeah, there's a lot of rhetoric. There's a lot of rhetoric surrounding this thing. There's a lot of rhetoric in any war, but this war, this catastrophe, this genocide has really been a media war, a media genocide, and both its justifications and its persistence are really, you know, it really becomes a contest between whose narrative wins, whose narrative is more compelling. And again, that's the thing that the current hunger crisis, which may be deemed a famine shortly, like officially a capital F famine, IPC phase 5 famine. One of the things that it's done is creating a narrative. It is reifying a narrative that Israel and its defenders can't really talk their way out of. They're trying, they're doing their best, but it's really hard. It's really hard when you look at pictures of starving children and starving old people and just massive devastation of food. It's something that you just look at it and you immediately identify with it, and it really engenders sympathy for the victims. And a genocide cannot continue if people with power and influence feel sympathy for the victims, because then they won't allow it to continue. So I think that's a lot of what's going on.
Well, Jonathan, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to find you, theracket.news is the place to do so. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that is our show. We will be back next week. See you later.
On the 12th of October, we will be marching and commemorating 2 years of genocide, 2 years of resistance, and 2 years of steadfastness. The Palestinian people here in Naam and the community will be marching together. We invite you all to join us and stand side by side to call for justice for the Palestinian people in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in Nablus, in Nafa, and in all the cities. We have been marching for the last 103 weeks, back to back, calling for justice for Palestine and calling to sanction Israel. It is our duty to stand together with the oppressed. Join us on Sunday, 12th of October, at the State Library, 12 o'clock. And remember, always, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanston Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.